Hello, this is an interview with Mark Watson in the centre of Manchester on the 21st of January 2014. Well, first of all then, Mark, could you tell me where you were born and when you were born?
I was born on the 15th of March 1953 in St Anne's Nursing Home, Headington, in Oxford.
And were you there for a long, were you in Oxford for a long time? Or
my parents were both students in Oxford and met there and got married there and lived in Oxford. In fact, my mother's lived in the same street now for over 60 years.
So what happened then? So did
so I went to school in Oxford, a very interesting place with the Botanic Gardens and other such places to visit, and I didn't like school very much, but I became interested in geology on a holiday to the Lake District, on a very wet holiday to the Lake District when we couldn't go walking. I persuaded the school authorities to let me do geology as an A-level, that got me a place at the Red Brick University, the Victoria University of Manchester, where I was there from 71, 72, 73, 74, where I got my degree, and of course I lived in and around Manchester.
So what happened then? What did you do?
I went to a number of job, not exactly interviews, but a firm would, a company would hire a hotel and we would go and listen to what they had to offer. And I went to one and I liked, quite liked what they were offering. And I've been turned down by all the others, so I took a job with them. In fact, I never had a job interview, I just joined. And so I joined a company, and for the next went until 1986, so 1974 to 1986, I worked all over the world on oil rigs as a petroleum geologist.
Right. Now, can I take you back a little bit then? Because one of the reasons you're being interviewed is because of the your grandfather and the Red House.
Yes.
So can you tell me about that connection?
Yes. My mother's father was Mr. James Smith, and he was a Lancastrian, as was she, as is she. When he was a boy, he had gone to school at Sedbergh, and then he had left and joined the family firm, which was a cotton firm in Blackburn. And they had a mill called Hull House Mill, which had originally been the Peel's Mill before the Luddites wrecked it. And so he worked with his father and brothers in the family firm, and they had a place at the Royal Exchange, and you can find all their names in the Royal Exchange directories, so we know just where they stood. I can't just remember the dates, but I think in the 20s, all of a sudden his name disappears and the company name disappears. And in the following year, his name appears with the Lancashire Cotton Corporation. Now, I don't know whether they were absorbed by the Lancashire Corporation or he left and went there. I think probably lots of firms were getting together as things were starting to look bad. And then his name is there for a couple of years, as I remember. And then it disappears for a few years, and then it reappears with Courtauld's. And he rose up the ranks in Courtauld's, sales manager in the rayon division, until he became a director. And at this point, he has to travel around all over the show. So they move from Bolton, where my mother was as a child, to the Red House, Chelford, which was halfway between Manchester and Crewe, with what he and not far from the Manchester to Stoke line. Of course, everybody travelled by rail then, no planes, no motorways. That was a strategic place to live. So he bought this plot of land, which had a big garden in it, half a flower garden and half a vegetable garden, although more complicated than that. had a big Edwardian house in it made of Accrington or similar brick, and red terracotta and red tiles. Hence the name. And it really was quite a big house. There was an enormous... So it was built on the sort of Victorian system of sunlight shining in the dining room at one point of the day, the in another room, so as the sun went round. And two of the rooms have been converted into a very large lounge, I think possibly by him when he first went there. And there was a rather naff sandstone foyer porch on the front, out of character with the house, put on, I think, by him when he first moved there, but he had no architectural sense whatsoever. So there you are, that's roughly it.
Mm-hmm. So did you stay there or what?
We must have spent most of our holidays there. Most Christmases there, most of the time. And of course there were no motorways then, and it was an 8-hour journey from Oxford to Manchester. Mm. Whereas I go and visit my mother now, and I set off, and I have, 8 hours there. Completely different setup today.
Mm-hmm. So did you carry on visiting there?
When I became a student, mm-hmm. I sort of went there a lot, and mm-hmm. for the last two terms, I lived my last two terms there, and got the train mm-hmm. to when the train fare was curiously enough, the train fare from Piccadilly to Chelford was 62 pence return, 63 pence single.
Can you describe then, you've talked about the house and the gardens very well, could you describe the garden a bit more, do you think?
Right, the land on which the house and the garden is quite long, so it's probably four or five times, or maybe even five or six times longer than it is wide, mm. and it's on Snelson, it's right at the corner of Snelson, which is next to Chelford. And it's on what's now called Peaver Street, I think, and a lane that goes off Peaver Street, the name of which I can't remember, and maybe I've never known. So it's in the corner of the road. And there was a front gate with a hedge on either side, a wooden gate with iron posts. So the gate was a replacement for an original iron gate. Possibly went during the war, who knows. On the Peaver Street side, and then about a third of the way down the lane on the side, there was what you might call a back entrance, and you went in there where there was a yard and then a garage, possibly Edwardian garage, and then the house was sort of between the two gates, if you like. And then the house was surrounded by lots of trees, and there was a big rockery between one side of the house and the lane, and on the other side there was a big lawn with a big tree in the middle of it. And then at the back of the house there was a path that went down to the bottom part of the garden. There was a large lawn which had a tennis court on it, with the tennis court stuff was laid out in the back of the garage mm-hmm. when it wasn't being used, and there was a cherry tree on one side of the lawn which thrived on coffee grains. And then behind the tennis court, cutting the whole property into two, roughly speaking, was a hedge and trees growing all the way along it. And then behind that, in the middle of the garden, there was an orchard. And from time to time, they planted new trees. I remember that my grandfather was particularly keen on James Greaves apples, and there were certainly a couple of Victoria plums there. And then the front part of the garden on the other side from the lane had had a fence all the way down, separating it from the next property. And the next property only got as far as the hedge, And then there was a field on the other side, rather than the next property, for the rest of the very long Red House property. There was a field, and then there was a long fence all the way down here, which had loganberries and blackberries trained up it. And then there was a hedge across the bottom of the garden, which went onto another lane coming off the lane previously referred to, and there was a gate there where occasionally stuff could be brought in, but it was nearly always closed. And then right at the bottom of the garden there was an area of grass, and there was throughout the winter months, and that there was a big bonfire there because there were a vast amount of leaves produced. Actually, looking back at it today, horrific that all these were burned. They should have all been composted. Anyway, all these were damp, and he used to go to the local garage and get tyres and fill the tyres with newspaper, put a match to it, and you could burn the wettest leaves just like that. By today's standard, the most extraordinarily uneco thing to do. And then there was a hedge cutting all this off, and then there were a couple of big sheds which were replaced in about 1962, I should think. There were two old sheds there, and they were replaced in about 1962 when he retired and took more interest in the garden. And then a large part of the on one side of the on one side of the garden next to the fence with the blackberries on it, this was the vegetable garden, and this was quite big. I suppose the whole property might have been 150 metres long. So this vegetable garden moved about. There was a lot of, nothing was grown in the same place. There was a proper rotational system. I remember as a little boy absolutely loving kale, and I still love kale. It's just about the tastiest vegetable, and they grew every vegetable under the sun. Marrows. Oh, there was a great big long frame across the middle of the vegetable garden, which was full of marrows and all sorts of other things. One of the sheds contained materials that weren't used very often. The other one was lined with pegs with dozens of tools, and there was a lawnmower and a rotavator thing, all sorts of stuff. And there was a big bench down one side where the light came in with a vise, and there was everything you needed to maintain machinery for the garden. I think the lawnmower was an Atco. I can't remember the make of the cultivators. There were two cultivators. And then there were all these wonderful wooden handled tools. Very little stainless steel that hadn't really come in yet. And there were oily rags. There were pots of oil. When any tool was used, it was scraped absolutely clean and then painted with an oil, with old engine oil. Then there was a sandpit where we played as children, and there was a sycamore tree next to it, and we were always being warned not to eat the berries or seeds of the sycamore tree. So the garden was divided into two by the hedge that I referred to, and at one end of that hedge, on the other side from the lane, was an enormous poplar tree, now gone. I mean, absolutely huge poplar tree. You could see it for miles. You could see it from the railway line. So when you were passing, if you were going with a friend on the railway, you could point at, oh, that's where my granddad lives.
They're quite a big. It's big.
Oh yeah.
What
you're
talking
yeah.
about.
My grandmother died. I can't remember exactly when she died. I was still working on the oil rig, so before 1986. Because I couldn't go to her funeral, and then he got to the state where he couldn't look after all this lot, so he went to an old people's home, and the house was sold at that point. Now I've forgotten why I'm telling you this.
We were talking about the size of it, I think, and looking after it.
Can't remember.
Don't worry. Tell me about because I think probably there were two gardeners while you were...
Yes. When I first went there, there was a very nice man who lived in a little cottage opposite, which I suspect when he first went to live there wouldn't have had electricity or water, although I never remember that. And so his name was Frederick Sant. And his wife, I might be able to remember the name of his wife, but his wife was a very kind lady, and occasionally we used to go there for tea, and there were all beautiful sandwiches and all the rest of the sort of thing we would never have had at home. And this very, you know, house that it could have been 100 years before when you were there. And he worked very, very hard, this gardener, and he knew about gardening. He knew all about rotation and everything there was to know about domestic gardening he knew about. And I suppose that my grandfather, when he bought this house, I know he put himself into a lot of debt, but of course, as a director of Courtaulds, he was quite well paid. So he could afford to have a gardener. Whether the gardener had worked there before he was there, I don't know. Of course, gardeners were much more common then because wages were very much lower than they are now. So it's not, a lot more people had gardeners then.
Yeah.
So it's not quite as, you know, if I say, oh, my granddad had a gardener, everybody thinks this is terribly posh, but it was much more common then.
Yeah.
So he just worked there all the time. He couldn't drive, so if he had to go to the doctor or something, my grandmother would take him. And likewise, he would have been taken to Caldwell's when he needed to go. Once a year, my grandfather paid for him and his wife to go on the train to Southport Flowershow.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, when he retired, before he retired, Peter Lofthouse came to work as a gardener and learned a lot of him, I should imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he retired, he needed somewhere more suitable for an old person to live in.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather took him around all over the show, looking at hundreds of houses, well, dozens of houses. They found one on the Chelford side of Macclesfield, and he went to live there for a couple of years. And I remember him saying, or being told that he hadn't got enough money to buy it, so my grandmother, father made up the difference. So I imagine that at that time, that might have been a £4,000 or £5,000 house.
Mm-hmm.
Two up and two down, makes it sound like a terraced house, but a country version of that. So that he didn't have to get a mortgage. The old house was sold, my granddad made. Anyway, he lived, so this was on the edge, but in a town, Macclesfield. And after a couple of years, he was going completely mad because he had always lived in the countryside.
Mm.
So, and my granddad used to go make sure he was, well, it all sounds very paternalistic, but make sure he was all right. And anyway, it was quite plain that he was very unhappy there. So they went looking for another house, and I went on some of those expeditions. And eventually they found a house, a terraced house, an end terrace in Goostrey. In fact, it's the nearest end terrace house to the railway. And this was a much more expensive house, I think. Anyway, my granddad made up the difference, so maybe this was a £7,000 house. So, and we used to occasionally go there for tea. I remember going two or three times. And then what happened to Fred Sant after that, I have no idea, because I moved on by that time.
Yeah.
Mm. But Peter Lofthouse came. Now, Peter Lofthouse lived about maybe 100 metres or so from where Pepper Street joins the main road, further down towards Chelford from the Red House. And he lived there with his mother, who cleaned at the Red House, after another woman called Mrs. Slater, who lived in the village, got too old. because Mrs. Slater was my grandmother's age, so they, you know, they were all getting old together, as it were. And I think she probably came before Peter, but I can't remember. They might have come about the same time. Now, and Peter had a very poorly brother, and I think another brother. And I think the very poorly brother's probably died, but I don't know. And I might be confusing the poorly one with the one who's still alive. They both live there in the same house, as far as I know.
They do.
And I have no idea when his parents died. His mother was a nice, really, really hard-working woman. The father was said to be a complete layabout and was said to bully him a lot. I hadn't any personal, but that's what people in the village said. He was a perfectly pleasant man, but he never seemed to do anything. And then Peter's own garden was not very big. It's a sort of triangular shaped garden next to the road, maybe 50 metres long, maybe, I can't remember, maybe 25 metres long. And of course the family must have lived on the healthiest diet you could possibly imagine, because they weren't very well off, and I think they pretty much lived off the garden. When I passed it the other day, it looked exactly the same. It had a car parked outside. Now, I do remember the first, I think Peter had no control over how his money was spent when he was there. And one of the first things they did was to buy a Moskvich, and that was because it was really, really cheap, and it meant that they as a family could get around. And of course, everybody owned second-hand cars at that time in a way that they don't today. That is to say, second-hand rustic cars in a way that they don't today. And then later on he got a better car. Of course, getting a car meant that he needed to be able to drive. Now, of course, he was able to drive because my grandfather had realised that it was in his interest, let alone Peter's, to teach him. So my grandfather paid for him to learn to drive. And indeed, whenever they went out, he sat in the passenger seat to give him practice. He passed his test first time, I think, in Macclesfield. So Peter learned to drive on a vomit-coloured mini traveller, you know, the ones with the wood round the thing. As did I, as it happens. Same car. And in fact, I used to go to the Peak District a lot, and Peter must have driven me 1,000 miles around the Peak District. And so I would drive a bit, show him what to do. So to say I taught him to learn to drive would be a complete exaggeration, but he did a great deal of driving with me, and he was, you know, a completely different person to me, as you can imagine. But he was an absolutely charming, hard-working. I mean, you felt he worked so hard for my grandfather and looked out for him so much that you just wanted to make sure he was properly, you know. And also, I used to work on the oil rigs, so I was often going to the airport, and ordering a taxi at 4 o'clock in the morning was very unreliable. So I used to pay Peter over the. I was earning a lot of money then. I used to pay him over the top to get up at four and take me there, and then I usually got a taxi from the airport back because that was reliable. At that time, I had a Sunbeam Lotus, which would do 100 miles an hour in seconds, sort of thing. And I think he thought it was reasonably amusing to drive such a car home. So Peter started as an undergardener, although that term would never have been.
But he was very young.
Yeah. And he must have learnt a lot of Fred. And then when Fred went, I don't know whether he was part. He probably started when he was 16, I should think. Whether he started part time or I think he must have done. I think my grandfather must have realised he was going to need a gardener, and how he found Peter. Maybe his mother had already come to work there, so
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So Peter got more and more competent. I don't think he would ever have known as much as Fred, but he became a very competent gardener, very hardworking. And when my grandfather was realising, oh, he had a heart attack, so he started to realise that this couldn't go on forever. So I think he paid somebody to give him some lessons from Tattenhall. I'm not sure.
I think that's right.
Mm. I mean, I think he did go around making sure that Peter got a job. And then he went off to this old people's home, and the house was sold, unfortunately, just before the property boom. So I think they got 100,000 for the property. And I remember my aunt telling him that he ought to get planning permission for 2 bungalows, because that would double the value of the land. But he was having nothing of it. He didn't want his garden wrecked. And in actual fact, it's very difficult to get planning permission around there, because it's near to Jodrell Bank. I never saw Peter again after that, although I remember, just as the house was about to be sold, saying, and my granddad was in no fit state to do anything, so my aunt was dealing with the sale, and I remember saying to Peter, you must take all the tools that you want to out of the various, there was a greenhouse as well, out of the various sheds, but he wouldn't take any. I think he thought that they weren't mine but actually a lot of them would have been thrown away. A lot of them were so specialist that an ordinary gardener wouldn't know what to do with them. So I don't think he took any, which was a shame really, and I'd already bought what I needed, so I didn't take any. Or at least if I did, I can't remember. There were woodworking tools. My grandfather used to take woodworking lessons after he retired, so there was all sorts of fantastic. Between the garage, which was made of wood and was on its last legs, and the house was what was called a wash house. And then when he retired, he had the floor of that levelled with some horrible red stuff. And he had a bay window put in one side and a workbench so he could use this as a workshop. And then on the other side, there was a tub that had originally been used for washing, and that you could light a fire under that. And they used to light fires under that and sterilise soil for the greenhouse. Now, behind the wash house, there had been a creosoted wooden shed, I should think put up between the walls. Maybe when just after the house was built. And when he retired, lots of things happened. Central heating was put in. My grandmother could not freeze for the first time. And there was a greenhouse was put in. And he loved growing tomatoes and other things, but mostly tomatoes, because he liked tomatoes. And he was so proud of these things, he used to hand them out all over the village. And my grandmother used to get crackers, because there was never any left for the family. And on another occasion, I remember going to Caldwell's with him, and he bought all these tomato seeds. Usually, I think every now and again they bought tomato seeds, but most years they were collected and planted. But that didn't. They bought new stuff from time to time. And I remember my cousin and I seeing these yellow tomato seeds for yellow tomatoes, and we bought some out of our own pockets. And then we carefully opened his packets, poured out his red tomato seeds, and poured in the yellow tomato seeds. And he never did find out what had happened, but he couldn't understand why his. At first, he thought they weren't ripening, and then he realised they were ripening. He had no idea what was going on. Anyway, it didn't happen the next year. He must have thrown all those out. Anyway, one year we had only yellow tomatoes.
So can you tell me a bit? When did you start going to Caldwell's? Either with your granddad or with your
Chelford is on the main road from Macclesfield to Chelmsford, and my grandmother used to do 99% of her shopping in, no, 95% of her shopping in Knutsford, possibly a little bit in Alderley Edge and Manchester. And so that was more domestic stuff. And of course, as you go into Knutsford, Caldwell's was on the right where you go into Knutsford. And so sometimes we used to go in the car. I think I can remember doing that when we were very small, just going, and then later on having more memories of it when we would have been helping dig the vegetable garden or whatever. And I think we got 6 months an hour for digging the vegetable garden. Well, that would be, well, you could get an ice cream for 6 months, yeah. So I guess it would be £2 an hour in today's money. £1.50 anyway. As I remember, you drove off the road and you sort of parked on a bit on the right, and then you went across into the shops, and then there was more stuff at the back, of course, and tools and things were bought in the shop, and I remember him buying various stuff there, various things there, things like secateurs and things which needed to be replaced every now and again.
What was it like, the shops then?
It was quite, there seemed to be a lot of glazing on the shop, if I remember rightly, but this is all pretty hazy, really. I know a bit later on, I think he had an account there, and the reason I think that was because I think I bought stuff there for him, and sometimes for myself when I shouldn't have done, because he would never have noticed on the bill when that, you know, there were no credit cards then, or maybe Access was just coming in and Barclay card were just coming in, so everybody had accounts which were settled monthly or 6 monthly or whatever. I think when I bought my house, I bought a Spear and Jackson trowel and fork set, which came in a box which had a cellophane top. And I bought a stainless steel spade there, the one that you've just photographed. And I think I bought some other things there. I think I bought a sieve there. Anyway, that was for me. But he went in from time to time, and then when Peter learned to drive, I think he used to send Peter in. So that's another reason for thinking there was an account. Peter would have just put it on the account. Now, it may well be that these accounts, you could go and find these transactions.
Some of them, I think, still.
Yes.
Yeah, they're trying to transcribe a lot at the moment.
Yes.
So,
And
what about trees and shrubs and plants? Were you ever there?
Well, I was never there when they were planted, but I know that everything came from Caldwell's.
Yes.
He never went anywhere else. And from time to time, new things were planted in the garden. In particular, there's James Greaves. He used to buy, what are those little blue plants? Forget-me-nots. And then at the end of the year they'd all be shaken down for the seeds, is that right? But from time to time they bought new ones.
Yeah.
I remember those. They had these bark. They had enough forget-me-nots to fill this room, I think.
They do spread.
Mm. And I remember him buying some loganberries. And I remember, I think there might have been 8 loganberry and raspberry bushes down this wall, and I remember my father splaying them up. Putting wires down and displaying them up, because his fingers were green. There were lots of stuff in the garden that, funnily enough, my father made grow. Or at least that's the perception as a young person. And I can remember going there lots of times, and yet it's sort of hazy. towards the end, I think some of the place was perhaps levelled before it finished trading. I'm not quite sure. And they started building housing estates around it, whereas before it had been right on the edge of town.
Yeah.
And if you drive out now thinking it's on the edge of town, you've gone miles past where the site was.
Yeah.
And in fact, when I went there a few months ago to walk around there, we drove through Knutsford. And I was looking for where it was, and I got to that roundabout. I remember that round.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think there's two roundabouts on that road now, and I remember the first one being put in, and I didn't really remember the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, in just going past, I didn't realise where it was. I couldn't quite remember.
Mm-hmm.
They put the first roundabout in when they built the housing estate there.
Mm-hmm.
So
did you ever go onto the nursery itself, not just the shop, but actually out onto the nursery?
I think one time we went looking for some plants of some sort,
mm.
but what they were,
yeah.
I can't remember,
yeah. Yeah.
I'm afraid. Yes.
Mm.
I remember a lot more about my going into Knutsford with my grandmother and shopping at all
the
individual shops.
Yeah,
because,
tell me about that.
You could park anywhere,
mm-hmm.
because there weren't many cars,
mm-hmm.
there were no double yellow lines. I think you could even, yeah.
Mm.
So there was Watson's, the coffee shop, which had been there for years.
Mm.
And in fact, the whole town, of course, was where Edgerton was there. He didn't allow any industry in Knutsford or all around there. And that's why it's such a countrified place. There's no smoke. It was a nice place to live.
Mm.
And this was all because Edgerton wanted his wife to be able to go shopping there. I don't know whether anybody's put that bit.
Not quite that way.
But yes, that's right. And in fact, if you look on all the council houses and the town halls, there's E for Edgerton rather than a town crest.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you went past Caldwell's, down the hill, and in fact, on the right, there was a road that went, or is a road that goes to Mobley, and there was a pork butcher's called Hammond's there. The shop front's completely gone, made into a window now. And there are some Worthington cottages there. Anyway, if you go and you went under the railway bridge, past the library, which was a fantastic
mm.
Carnegie Alfred Derbyshire library,
mm.
which has survived quite well because it's a nursery now.
Mm.
And then there was Hewitt's, the toy shop, on the right. Fancy remembering that. And then there was Miss Bailey's, the greengrocer's, opposite Watson's. And then you went a bit further along, there was Hitchmo's, the ironmonger on the left. There's a place that's now called Bella Pock, which I think was the coffee house then. And there's a pot, Siamese cat, next to the fire. And that was there when I was a child, and it's still there. And of course, all the Mrs. Gaskell stuff. And then there was Quinn's, the... there were no tea shops or wine bars.
Mm.
There was Quinn's, the opticians, and then an antique dealer on the other side, and then Mr. Hulse, the shoemaker on the right, and then the post office, and then there was Spades, the fishmonger, and Spades, the greengrocers, and then on there was Canute Caff, which was much higher quality caff than it is today, much, 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 much higher. And all sorts of other stuff all over.
Mm.
And in fact, I enjoy going to Knutsford now, and if you see an old person, asking them where one of these shops is, and they go, oh, that's not been there for years, dear. So, and then the town hall, which is Waterhouse,
mm.
of course, and
mm.
the school by his brother-in-law next to it, which is now Marshall's, and Alfred Derbyshire, Owen, you know, all these.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Lee Road with all its Harding Watt houses. And all, I mean, you know, there were all these types of Harding Watt houses on the Lee Road. There was, you can see why Caldwell's had plenty of custom,
yeah.
because all these people could have, you know,
mm-hmm.
they couldn't, you know, it's not like today, things were done locally. And there were a lot of very rich people locally,
mm.
so you can see why Caldwell's. And of course, the very rich people lasted a bit longer. When I talk about very rich people, I mean people who understand that gardening is a long-term thing,
mm.
and is not,
mm.
you know, not somebody who has no idea. And that's probably why Caldwell's has gone, because the people who understand have gone as well. If you come out of Knutsford, down on the road towards the road that goes to Chester, past Tabley Hall, and turn left and go down to Tabley Hall, you pass a lodge called the White Lodge, which has an arch and living accommodation on each side. And in 1851, another great-great-great-grandfather lived there on a completely different side of the family. Anyway, that's nothing to do with Caldwell's.
Never mind.
Peter, yes, then he got a job at Tatton.
He did.
And I don't know whether he's retired or he's still there.
Oh, he's still there.
Still there, yes.
Saw him last year, I think.
So he, I suppose he had a lucky start to life, really. And I think luck favours the hard workers. He might have had a lucky start, but if he hadn't worked hard, that luck would have stopped. I have occasionally wondered what had happened to him, as you naturally would do. When I said to Barbara Moth, I do know somebody who might remember, I was astonished to find that you had already spoken to him.
And
it would also be very interesting to see how his story differed from what mine said, or whether some bits are the same and some bits are different but don't contradict. And it would be very interesting to know which bits contradict. The most interesting bit for me would be which bits contradicted.
I don't think they did, actually. I'll tell you more.
I think he was very happy at the Red House, and I think he was less happy at home. That was me looking inwards from an uninformed point of view.
He's fine now.
Good. I actually think his life must have improved when his father died.
Well, that's been fantastic. Thank you very much indeed for sharing all of that with us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.